Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with Ryan Skavnicki, who's been described as the godfather of the architecture meme. Ryan's also an educator, architectural theorist, and founder of the practice Extra Office. While Skavnicki is trained as an architect, he's primarily interested not in architecture as a physical object, but in the ever-expanding forms of media through which it's represented. Based in Akron, Ohio, he teaches a course at Kent State University called Theory and Criticism in Architectural Media, and he's really a creature of the internet, where he's very active on platforms like TikTok, Twitch, and of course, Instagram, using these venues as a means for teasing out new architectural ideas and critiques. I strongly recommend you watch his Twitch feed where he records himself playing various video games, performing a kind of spatial critique that's both insightful and often hilarious. Ryan and I recorded our conversation in mid-January 2022, where we talked about, among other things, the potential for meme culture to upend traditional hierarchies to form a new value system that encourages a more inclusive dialogue around architecture, defined as much by its critical rigor as its sense of humor. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. The reason I was so interested in talking with you is because it seems like we're at a unique crossroads right now in terms of what it means to be an architecture critic. And what I'm curious about is how this is overlapping with the role of the social media influencer and the content producer, because to me, you are all of these things. And I wondered if we could start with, I guess, your time at the University of Cincinnati. And, you know, following that, your transition to SciArc and the postgraduate program there in design theory and pedagogy. So can you walk me through, I guess, what kind of aspirations you had coming out of your undergrad degree, and then what pulled you towards the SciArc program and away from a more conventional practice?
I think that it sort of really frustrated me to see most architecture schools and institutions taking to social media in such a bland, kind of performative way to try to still be telling the same stories through a different medium. And I think that if I bring anything with me into new media, it's that we need different stories. I don't want to be telling the same stories about Mies and, you know, about Gropius or whatever. I want to be finding new pathways for architecture to spark people's interest, new reasons to engage it. And because I don't think we can. I think we have to leave some things behind. As a discipline. That doesn't mean like forget everything. That means like things need to become history and stop needing to try to continue to be contemporary, especially today.
I mean, with your work, it seems like it's as much about finding new mediums to tell stories as it is about telling new stories themselves. But, and for example, I mean, you're as quick to produce a critique of a video game, whether it's Fortnite or Zelda or Control or Grand Theft Auto. You have a Twitch account where you're very energetically involved in very in-depth analysis of architectural space in video games like that. But also, of course, the memes you make on Instagram themselves are their own kind of medium for telling different stories about architecture. But I mean, if we're talking about storytelling and history and the narrative of the practice and the culture of architecture, what is the story you're trying to tell now?
It's a great question.
And maybe it's too broad a question. Maybe the question should be more, maybe we'll kind of arrive at that question further down the line. But I guess there sounds like there's a dissatisfaction or frustration with the way, maybe in your education, people were thinking about architecture and its history and its significance, irrelevance to daily life. And it seems like part of this move from Cincinnati into SARC had to do with learning about different ways of thinking about architecture and teaching architecture. So maybe we could start or focus on that, and you could talk more about the agenda you had going into the SIARC program and what you came out of it with.
I mean, SIARC is a place that writes its own history, right? It clearly needed to be the place to go to think about new media and research topics, because I have a problem. Okay, my problem is that every time I find a new medium, I misbehave in it. I don't like to produce stuff with the intention of growth on any kind of channel. I typically like to try and undermine the kind of way that media is fed through that particular channel. So for example, on Instagram, memes are the kind of, they slowly get more and more kind of brought into a mainstream, right? But they misbehave on that channel really, really well. They have text in the image instead of in the caption, right? They are really poor quality. They don't look pleasing. They upset your feed's aesthetic potential, right? And I think a place like SIARC has the tools to really think about those problems and think about how not only do you use a tool for communication, but how you kind of break a tool and learn from it in a new way. And I think that that place for experimentation, that space for experimentation is always there at that school. And it's what led me to kind of not only think about architecture and teaching architecture on those channels, but how to work through mediums in such a way as to kind of upset their channels. Now, that's something I'm working on being better at in the production of media, and the future of my practice is one that I want to focus on producing media with the intention of a kind of sustainable media output growth pattern, more typical of a kind of media production, which is on its way. But
I think so. Yeah, I want to go back and chew a little more on what you've said. I guess starting with this critique or frustration around the standardized ways in which media is used. And if we're talking about Instagram, the moment in time that you started to make memes, the most popular accounts that were about architecture tended to be ones that would repost portfolio material or slick renderings or contemporary architectural projects in this endless bid for aesthetic pleasure and satisfaction and popularity. And also, we're probably in this period of the rise of the portfolio on Instagram as well, where everything is considered and each post is kind of mapped onto a 9-square grid to say something more about the, in a very controlled way, about the user of the account. And so you're coming into this context really trying to stir things and upset things and make imagery that's dirty and confusing and erratic. And to me, that kind of irreverence and that attraction to kind of anti-establishment way of thinking about architectural culture does seem to have a home in SciArc as well as an institution. Further to that point, I saw a lecture that you gave there where you were talking about or making analogies between SpongeBob SquarePants and object-oriented ontology. And it felt like a 10-minute extended Instagram meme. Like if a meme became a public lecture, that's what it would look like. And I could tell that you were taking a lot of pleasure in standing up there and doing that kind of performance as well. You were doing something that on the face of it seemed gleefully irresponsible and inappropriate. And yet was also fascinating and making your audience think differently about, in this case, a pretty obtuse and hard to understand philosophical term.
Sure. I take a lot from Hito Sterl's Defense of the Poor Image, which was a piece of writing essentially mapping out ideas and techniques for how low quality, low res images are how you kind of become disruptive on these channels. I thought that when I graduated from Cincinnati, I spent a good 6 months hashtagging every drawing I was making with, what was it at the time, Super Architects and Arc Daily and just everybody, and just constantly trying to become a part of that system or that group. But I think that the more I looked into it, the more the obsession over perfection, the more the 9-square, the more the kind of really polished architectural drawing fetish became for me a thing that was so clearly disciplined into people that we are not only willing, but like very willing to sort of fight for as like, this is the architect, right? This sort of extremely clean and neat aesthetic producing object with drawings and very clean lines. And I don't think that's a realistic way of operating in contemporary space. I know that that's not extremely clear. But I think there's a particular person who can do that. But I don't see a reason to continue that as the only version of the architect that we as a culture, as an architecture culture, are willing to accept. I think there are architects that are messy. Most architects I meet are very messy. Their spaces can be very clean, but like, you know, we're thinking about a lot of things. We're in progress, in process all the time. Things aren't quite as neat as we like to pretend they are. And so, and actual architecture making is an incredibly sloppy and messy process that is beautiful for that reason. And I think, does that make sense? Like, I think that type of shift is necessary.
Yeah, I mean, to me, a lot of meme culture has to do with calling out bullshit that exists in the way that our thinking has been institutionalized. And it's about somehow untying us from these really restricted or policed or limited ways of understanding the work we do and the role we play in the profession we've chosen. And they also have to do with this pursuit for something genuine or something more real in some way. And that's the kind of vibe I get as well from the work of yours I've seen online, where there's this really unselfconscious I'm trying to find other words to frame it, kind of gleeful delight in whatever it is you've trained your critical eye on, whether it is a video game or an influencer interior designer's greenwashing of a project, or in one case, I think you're comparing like a chalupa with a hamburger, a new hamburger that just came out of Burger King, and then another kind of sandwich from McDonald's. And it's the same, you're taking the same intensity and joy and rigor to these acts of criticism across these vastly different levels of culture, whether it's the incredibly lowbrow or the highly complex and theoretical. And the meme seems to be a way of bridging all of those tiers. The other thing I was thinking of as you're talking about this like perpetually unfinished state that you see architecture being in is also a certain aesthetic that I've read you've been drawn to as well, even before you became more involved in architectural theory or becoming a teacher yourself. And there's a project by a practice called Coop Himmelblau, where you are in Akron right now, the Akron Art Museum. And if anyone listening is familiar with Coop Himmelblau, this is a postmodernist practice from Vienna. And their aesthetic is one of, I don't know, total discord. Like it's as kind of chaotic and deconstructed as you can imagine it being. And I know that you're really drawn to that building in particular as a teenager, right?
Yeah.
And then you actually went on to work briefly for Coop Himmelblau in Vienna.
Yes. There are some things I just can't get out of my head. And I think that it's okay to still, as a critic, I have to say what I love, right? When I was a kid, when I was interested in architecture, I actually grew up in the Cleveland Akron area. And my dad took me to a lecture at the Akron Public Library about art museum architecture. And whoever they were, which I don't know to this day who that person was, but they were talking about new art museums in the United States. And they were talking about Calatrava in Milwaukee, which was being designed and constructed, or it was finished. It was close. And then they were talking about the Kansas City Art Museum by Stephen Hall. And I believe then they talked about the Cleveland Museum of Art. I'm not entirely sure, but they didn't talk about the Akron Art Museum, which was right across the street. And it was under construction. And I'm looking at this hulking mass of twisted steel. And I'm 16, 17 years old. And I'm like, all I could say to myself is, what the fuck is that? Like, what the hell is that thing? Why is that there? How did this happen? It looks beautiful and wasteful and stupid, and yet I'm drawn to this object in a way that I'm not fully understanding. And so that's why I decided to study architecture. That's why I eventually went to work there, because I liked the practice and I liked the buildings. Funny enough, I ended up renting, my wife and I rented that building and we got married there. So it's a little too personal, but it ended up just being a really, really good deal and a really great space. So I was like, all right, sure. I mean, it's not like an obsession. It's not like I go there, or anything, but it is a part of the history of what brought me to this moment.
Mm. It's interesting though, because in the work you do now, there's a much stronger fixation on the world of images and a virtual space, less so on physical architecture. So can you tell me more about the shift towards the world of media and why that was important for you?
Yeah, I feel like I think of theory and I think of theory way more as a practice. And I think of criticism way more as a practice than I do of like this thing that floats around in books. The theory is the feed. The theory is the hive mind meme page. The theory is the, a TikTok account. I think those are all sort of bona fide methods of the production of contemporary theory. I just because it's not written down in log, doesn't make it a kind of theoretical question. And I gain much more insight to the way that, much more insight on the way that people are thinking about space when I look at the way that regular people might meme about video game spaces or bring video game spaces into their home than I do reading log.
Mm-hmm. And just for listeners who might not be familiar, log is a architectural journal published in the US. I mean, I'm thinking about a particular meme I think you made that has, it's a kind of rehashing of that standard meme of a line full of people, a queue full of people at one stall, and then maybe like one person at the other stall, and everyone's lined up to consume their memes. And there's like one lonely person at the log stall. Mm-hmm. In a way that suggests that the meme is superseding the peer-reviewed journal article or the monograph, coffee table monograph, or the, op-ed in a paper or something. It's like the meme has this gravitational pull and sense of significance. At the same time, though, memes are these short, sharp shocks of information and insight that are so short-lived in terms of, in a way, our reflection on them. Literally, we scroll very rapidly through this information and are delivered some kind of jolt of dopamine, whether it's to do with enjoying the irony of the post or the schadenfreude or the kind of the shit posting or the call-out post, or all these things elicit really strong emotions. So how do you sustain criticism within an ecosystem of memes? How do you avoid it becoming simply scrollable and likable, but ultimately passed over and forgotten?
There's a few answers.
And it's funny, sorry, one... just the way I'm asking it, it's like you're this guru of memes, which I know... isn't exactly the case, but there was this. So just to kind of maybe contextualize like why I'm asking you in this way, you had posted recently about an article in Architectural Digest. It was a listicle, actually, which was calling you the godfather of the architecture meme or something.
Right.
So again, it's a listicle on a Architectural Digest, but... So the stakes aren't super high here, but at the same time, it's interesting that in some way you're being seen as, if not an early adopter, then some kind of godfather figure in this new culture of meme making.
I very much accept the title. it is very cool.
But yeah, to go back to the question, though.
Sure.
Yeah, about how real criticism is sustained in the medium of the meme.
The easy answer is that memes help form a easily digestible thesis of a longer form architecture criticism. The meme is just representative of the kind of distilled ideas of any given thing. Mm-hmm. When it becomes sort of shit posting, it becomes something that's just sort of repeated out there, a feeling, a vibe, a thought, a prayer, an instinct mm-hmm. that people either agree with, feel, emote, want to speak, want to participate in, even if they're not the ones saying it. It's like how you build momentum around any sort of socially driven changes is first to just sort of build an idea, a feeling. And this was actually the Situationalists in Paris pre-1968 were building momentum around their causes via graffiti, which was no more a critique than a meme is, in that they were, ne travaillez jamais, never work, right? A joke, but a hidden kind of message about labor and the kind of silliness of contemporary life that built momentum into a very deep seated project.
Maybe this is a good time to talk more about your own teaching and the kind of ideas you're instilling in the students that you're working with. So you're an adjunct faculty at Kent State University. What are you teaching there? What kind of position are you bringing into the school? What ideas are you trying to engage your students with now?
SciArc was the program where that type of thinking about architectural thinking as a tool to use to look at any other aspects of the world, not just buildings, was a place where I kind of learned that as a value, right? I learned that as a value. And so I do believe strongly in instilling that value in students, even though, you know, you're at a school where you're really focusing on the being produced as an architect. Keep in mind that there are, I think the AIA did a study about career paths for architects, and there were over 100 that weren't in architecture about possible career paths. And this was like in the 90s. I was just reading about it. And, you know, that there are so many other paths and places where we need architectural thinking. And that's kind of a value that I instill.
But I want to know what you're actually teaching there.
Oh, well, okay. I teach a second year undergraduate architecture studio where I involve video games as a precedent. So I actually have the students study a particular video game and break down its spaces into and draw and study the way that the level presents a place and how it draws your eye and how your character moves through it, how it's designed for a particular body. And then we use that as the precedent to jump off into architecture production. And then I teach a course called Theory and Criticism in Architectural Media, which is why I removed emerging theorist from my Instagram handle and put theorist, because if you're teaching theory, you know, I think that the emerging title is, and we've spoken about this, but the emerging title is just kind of a laughable thing to me.
Mm-hmm. So this is just for listeners who might not be following this idea that emerging practices or emerging theorists have always been a thing in architecture, and it's often parodied now or satirized in a way that is skeptical of a practice that keeps its practitioners in a state of emergence almost throughout the entirety of their career. Like there's a kind of oppressiveness to be in a constant state of emergence and having never really arrived. And so that The emerging theorist title is one that another meme account, Dank Lloyd Wright, have ironically claimed in their bio or profile information on Instagram. I mean, maybe we could talk a bit about Dank Lloyd Wright or accounts like it and what your relationship is to this broader ecosystem of meme culture and architecture. I mean, Dank Lloyd Wright, as many listeners will be aware of, is an anonymous account that involves admin, I think, from around the world, but none of whom have revealed themselves, versus you, who are an individual and in a way are building a profile that will allow you to, I imagine, at some point leverage a certain kind of status you've cultivated and apply to other forms of practice in the future. But maybe that's a question to ask. Why for you is it important to claim ownership of the memes you make and have them kind of stand for you as an individual? And how are you, what are you going to do, I guess, with the attention that generates on you as a person or as an individual practitioner?
When I decided to experiment in meme space, the idea of being a part of academia, an insider to architecture, and yet being a kind of outsider, for lack of a better word, punk, seemed to me irresponsible. I found at the beginning of starting the research that a lot of the meme culture was coming from this place of anonymous, mocking, silly, funny, joking, but not serious. And so I wasn't sure how things would turn out, but I knew that keeping myself anonymous would be, for me, felt irresponsible, because you could be doing harm by putting something down or by putting something out there that was seen as kind of cyberbullying or something, right? Now I take responsibility for, you know, all of the bullshit that has matriculated. But I knew then that if I was right about this hunch that I had about meme pages and about the discipline needing to kind of splinter a little bit, shake loose a little bit, take itself less seriously, which is the mantra of Extra Office. If I was right, then I would be followed by many, many more meme pages who decide to participate in whatever way they feel comfortable, and that participation I could reflect on. And so I see a lot of meme pages who were anonymous become unanonymous by deciding to say, I'm a human behind this weird joke page. You know, people treat meme pages like they're media outlets, like, hey, make a meme about this or that. Like, this takes work. Right. This takes time. Like, there's energy and effort. There are, you know, Dank Lloyd Wright posts something like, you know, 20 posts a day. Like, there's people behind those really putting effort into it, some of which just gets totally remediated by the algorithm, and like, you gotta kind of be okay with that. It's a sort of useless, the embodiment of a kind of useless praxis that somehow generates a very important kind of feedback for people, or very important messages for people, and there's value, there's so much value in doing that. The way in which I have decided to utilize and focus all that attention is to, you know, build those communities, share those other pages, support those other meme pages create a kind of and establish a kind of new value system and for what architecture wants to become or how architecture on discourse can be thought of. Meme culture can sort of bottom up create and establish value systems for itself that it didn't used to before. And what I hope to do is establish through the Extra Office, establish some new types of media channels where people are more are just taking themselves less seriously when they talk about architecture's relationship to the world.
So you're mentioning Extra Office, and I'm just conscious we haven't actually talked about that yet, or what Extra Office is. And this is the title of your practice, which I'm just going to call up the website now so I can describe it to listeners. Is, I may be wrong on my terminology, but like maybe a web 1.0 aesthetic. There's like a starry background with rainbow serif text that says Extra Office. And it's actually, the front page is a merch page. You're selling t-shirts and mugs and baby clothes. They all have kind of architectural meme slogans on them. One of my favorites is a t-shirt that just says, "This building sucks." You're also offering up your services as a desk critic to architectural students. And just seeing this makes me realize like how entrepreneurial your practice is, and how in a way you are extending your efforts out in so many different directions here, trying to find, I don't know, some traction or a specific route. And I know the last time we spoke, it sounded like you were feeling more pressure to start to double down on a specific avenue. And I wondered if you could talk more about what direction your work is going in now, keeping in mind that in addition to Extra Office, you also have a practice with your partner, Kristen Mims, called Miscellaneous, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of list, I think for myself, it's helpful to kind of list all of these efforts. So you're teaching at Kent State University. You run a popular architecture meme page. You have this practice called Extra Office, which is a kind of banner, I guess, for the work you do across different mediums. You have this practice making real architecture projects called MISC Partners. So where, I mean, why I'm listing this all out is because I feel like this condition is so familiar that I feel like I know a lot of people who have somehow found themselves diversifying, you know, coming out of architecture practice or out of their education in architecture, and now applying their skills and expertise on many different tracks simultaneously. And I'm just curious for you whether that's sustainable in the long run, or whether or not you are now starting to try and narrow your focus.
Yeah, thank you. I totally echo the sentiment where it feels like everyone in our generation has like five different things we're all doing at the same time. We've got some clunky website we built a few years ago that has like our services on there in case our crazy uncle ever wants their house drawn or something. And then we've got the hopeful kind of entrepreneurial avenues. We've got side hustles. And I think that the current generation above us, older generation, has a really difficult time understanding just what it's like to participate in the economic state of like of the gig economy, and how just trudging it can feel. And how most of us who have side hustles are allowed to do so because of our, you know, a particular kind of economic situation, right? There are those among our generation who really can't afford to do that because they're like, no, I need a job. Like I've got a kid, right? Like, or I've got, you know, I don't have the time or space to just like be screwing around with this stuff. So I'd like to say that at first, but I myself have had a lot of, what do they call it? I lost the word. Irons in the fire.
Okay.
I was like, what is it? I was like, wait, like, stoking what? Torches in the fire? I'm like,
it's like too analog a reference. It's somehow like hard to access now.
Right. Too analog a reference. Yes. And trying to figure out just exactly what or how I wanted to participate with architecture culture and what I have to offer and how to make what I have to offer work for me. And so basically I'm focusing in on the Extra Office itself as a media production platform and a extra institutional space to find and build knowledge. And so I'm looking at running some summer courses and creating interviews and content on TikTok, YouTube, Twitch, and really doubling down on becoming a media practice as a form, not only to support different types of criticism in architecture, because I think that the best place to find support is through audience building for particular ideas, and that if that audience wants and feels like these media platforms are important, then it'll be audience supported. And so the hope is that by really focusing on the production of content and ideas, I can and consistent content, that I can support the endeavor to build a new way of thinking about architecture, or a new by thinking about platforms rather than thinking about architecture itself.
One last question I had was around this book that you often cite as a big influence for you, called Infinite Game, or The Infinite Game. It was published in 1986 by the religious scholar James P. Carse. And just the title alone, to me, sounds like an apt description for the kind of criticism that you engage in, where everything is available for critique. Like I was saying before, regardless of whether it's highbrow or lowbrow, whether it's within or outside of kind of the common conception of what constitutes architecture, you can take this intense delight in critiquing the world we live in now in a way that's playful and does feel infinite. And I just wonder, what is the significance of that book to you, and how is it informing the work you're going to do moving forward?
The book starts out with a very provocative sentence. It says, there are at least two types of games. Finite games are games which are meant to be ended, and infinite games are games in which the goal is to keep the game going. And you find that if you think about a lot of what you produce under these terms, you think about the fact that not all games are games that you're trying to win, but games that you're trying to participate in as a player. architecture is an infinite game, right? Where we're constantly producing, and some of this comes, well, a lot of it comes from books. Some of it comes from interviews with people and theorists who I've had a great deal of luck, who I've been able to spend a lot of time around. Jeff Kipnis, Aaron Betsky, David Rue, people at SciArc, people at outside of people at the School of Architecture Taliesin, where I've, you know, really gained a lot of insight into how the infinite game of architecture has always been there. It's just not made it into the books because that was the secret, right? But the world is full of holes. It's full of cameras. It's full of moments. And I say we just be honest about those moments and create a new formulation of what it means to participate in this infinite game together, and how we share and uplift each other on those platforms is really important to me.
Mm. Ryan, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, hell yeah. You're like Matthew, you're like, sorry, I'm like off the cuff here, but like, you're an amazing interviewer.
Thank you. That's really nice to hear.
That's a serious skill. It takes skill. And like, I've never felt so seen in a way that I'm like totally shocked by it.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Ryan Skavnicki, thanks as always to Skanda Lynn, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.